Hi, I'm Quentin Lewis.
And I'm Taryn Lewis, and we are the co-founders of Urban Eden.
And this is our startup story.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story. And every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning. And every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is the startup story. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Startup Story. This episode is a bit longer than most because we spend a decent amount of time discussing a topic that is, well, considered uncomfortable for some and necessary for many others. That topic is related to the challenges of being a Black founder and how the events of 2020 helped our guests scale to heights they could have never imagined. But before we jump into it, I want to say thank you to Amy Rowland and the team at Various Search. Various Search is a boutique legal recruiting firm that uses a bespoke approach to fill legal departmental roles within your company. Now, whether it's general counsel or a paralegal, they have a particular focus on startups and growing tech companies, which is why I wanted to bring them and get them in front of you. Various Search is a boutique firm which allows them to provide individualized, in-depth attention to both their clients and to their searches. They focus solely on placing in-house candidates, which allows them to give their clients a bespoke experience in filling their legal needs. Their matchmaking approach ensures that clients are paired with candidates who not only have a great set of credentials, but also have a good cultural fit for your growing company. To learn more about Various Search, please visit their website at variassearch.com, and that's V-A-R-I-A-Search.com. Now let's jump into this week's episode. My guest this week is Quentin and Taryn Lewis, the co-founders of Urban Eden. Urban Eden is an all-natural, plant-based bath and beauty company based out of the Atlanta area. Last year, I had the privilege of sitting with Jamie Schmidt, who sold Schmidt's Naturals to Unilever for hundreds of millions of dollars after she spent 7 years growing it from her kitchen through the farmers markets and into the stores all over the world. You know, we unpacked her story after her successful exit. Well, Quentin and Taryn Lewis play in that same space, so we could very well be hearing the makings of another incredible growth story in the making. In fact, at the end of 2019, they headed into 2020 with hopes of closing approximately $600,000 in product sales and ended up exceeding that figure by 450%. You heard me correctly. In a year that decimated so many businesses, this is one of those stories of success. And in this episode, we discuss the challenges that that unforeseen growth brought to their business as well as their personal lives. And you're fooling yourselves if you think that type of unforeseen growth isn't painful, because it is. We also have a very raw discussion about the challenges of being a Black founder, and not just from the perspective of being a Black founder when most founders are white, but we also discuss the challenges of being a Black founder that are brought on by the Black community. Again, this episode hits on some real and raw topics, but these are ones that need to be heard. Yet, like all of our startup stories, we can't jump to those discussions until we understand the entire journey. So for that reason, let's start at the very beginning.
I was not raised, well, I actually was raised around entrepreneurs and my grandparents, but my parents in particular were not entrepreneurs. My dad was in the military for about 25 years. I think it might have been like 25 or 26 years. And my mom, she's done various jobs and just got a lot of college education throughout the years and work jobs. But my grandparents, so my grandmother actually was a Mary Kay sales director.
There we go. Yep.
All her life, all my life. All that I've seen. So I always saw her working from home and, of course, like cooking and taking care of the home there. And then my grandfather is a pastor and he actually has a school down in a Christian school down in Pensacola. And he's a Virgo like me, like I like to attribute to it. And I just talked to him not too long ago, but he has this thing going on. So I can get the entrepreneur spirit from them. But personally, I wasn't like entrepreneurial minded as a kid.
Yeah, yeah. So no early side hustles, no bubblegum hustles, no garage selling and trying to make some money, nothing like that.
I was not as a kid. I really did not do like, I was very like into clothes and really like fashion. I was a thrift store shopper. Now, you know, when I was like, well, not until I got into college, I did like some selling of like my clothes that I would wear. I would just resell those. Yeah. So that was like my introduction. That was about it.
Now, what about you, Quentin? I mean, obviously from your childhood, I mean, you're an entrepreneur now, but your early days, were you surrounded by entrepreneurs?
So I wasn't particularly surrounded by entrepreneurs. I think my dad had my dad is a salesman. He was a salesman. He was a car salesman for like 10 plus years. He did used to kind of hustle and kind of sell clothes, but he didn't like have like an actual, like, I wouldn't call it a business.
Okay.
You know, I kind of call it like a hustle. My mom was just, you know, traditional, just went to school, got, you know, a regular job and whatnot. My grandmother, she had a daycare business, and she was the one that kind of introduced me, I would say, to like, hey, you can go cut that person's grass for $20. And she would take me to my great grandfather's house and I would cut his grass. I remember in school, in high school, my dad worked at a vending machine company. And you know, in vending machine companies, you have to take the candy out if it's a day over the date.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He would bring the old candy home and I would take it to school and I would sell it for cheaper than the vending machine. You know, I had this lay low doing that, but that was my early introduction to selling things, was selling that candy in high school.
I love it. I love that. I mean, most entrepreneurs have some type of, I call it the bubblegum hustle. Like there's just, there's someone, you know, their parents gave them milk money. They stop by 7-Eleven or whatever, grab a bubblegum, sell for a dollar a piece or whatever. Like everyone's got something. I love it. But Taryn, when you come to the end of high school, I mean, military is part of your family. Ministry is part of your family. Mary Kay is part of the family. I mean, there's a lot of diversity in the exposure of what your future could be. Mm-hmm. So when you were coming to the end of high school, what did you think you wanted to do?
When I came to the end of high school, well, I went to college. I knew my mom because my mom is what you call like a professional student. She did it like she was in school for a long time. And so, of course, coming out of high school, that was really my option, was college or the military. And my mom was very big on like me having to go to college. So I just was picking something. I was like, I'm going to just be like a journalism major. I've always loved to like talk. So I was like, I'll just do something where like I'm a news reporter or something in journalism, in the journalism field. That was the only thing I was thinking about.
One of the downsides to podcasting is that the audience can't just see all the different mannerisms as the interview is taking place. But Quentin has been pretty stoic as Taryn's talking. And the moment she says, I really like to talk, he just starts nodding his head. like just the nuances of podcasting that don't come across.
So, she does.
I love it. Absolutely love it. So you thought something around journalism was really what you were feeling.
Yes, that's all I was thinking, was something around journalism.
Now, that obviously meant college, right? I mean, I don't think was there a field in journalism you were thinking where I don't have to go to college for, or you just knew college was next step?
My mom was very integral in my life, so it was really college. Like, okay. I wasn't thinking military. She was like, you're going to go to college. She held a college night for all my friends for us to do applications. So I picked Georgia State because at first I wanted to go to, like, Spelman, but they weren't offering, like, some of the things that I wanted to do. And I picked Georgia State, and they had, like, communications and broadcasting, and then I got into public relations. So I was going to start to go down the field of public relations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there we go. So, Quentin, how about you? Like, coming in the end of high school for you, what did you think your next steps were?
Man, crazy thing is that I was a sports head. I played football all through high school in my earlier years. So I was just thinking sports. I knew because of religious reasons that I wasn't going to play college football. So I just wanted to do something in sports. So I actually got into exercise science. I went to Georgia State as well. That's where me and Taryn met, was at Georgia State. So exercise science was the thing that I was looking at. I wasn't even thinking business or anything like that. It wasn't until I dropped out that I started thinking about business. But exercise science was the thing, because I wanted to stay within the sports, because I'm a sports fanatic. Like, if I weren't doing what I was doing now, I would be doing something in sports.
Okay. All right. So, but with that said, if being in sports was part of what you saw for your future, what was your step outside of college? Like, you know, obviously you meet Taryn, a relationship develops while in college, but coming out of college, what was your first job?
I actually interned at an urban farm. I think that I would say, when you said that was probably like my first kind of like thing outside of college, Taryn, was probably the intern at the urban farm.
Didn't you take on Brickman Group when you were doing the vegetable garden?
Oh, yes. Like, I'm sorry. I was really into gardening before all of this. And I got a job at a commercial landscaping company as like a gardener. So I was designing gardens. So that was like my first job or whatnot. Because I was trying to, after the sports thing, and after I wasn't going to do that, I kind of shifted my mindset to gardening, which is a whole story behind it. But I start getting into that. And then I wanted to monetize those skills. So then I worked for a commercial landscape company to kind of understand that side of things.
So there sounds like there's a lot that took place in your college years, Quentin. And before we get to unpacking Taryn's college years, you enter college, Quentin, wanting to do something in sports. Yet when I ask what you do afterwards, it's in landscape design or gardening. Mm-hmm. What happened in those college years where it's like, I'm not pursuing sports And this is a route that is of interest to me because they're so very different, especially these particular interests.
I think really what happened was that, you know, I'm in school. I really find myself doing what everybody else is doing. I'm just in the college life. You know, I'm partying. Mm-hmm. I'm going to class. I feel like the average person. I'm just doing what everyone else is doing. It wasn't until I actually met a contractor. This was like right after high school. And he introduced me to gardening. Fast forward, I get an internship at an urban farm. And I start getting into growing food and just urban farms. And that actually around that 2011, 2012 time, it was kind of becoming popular, like people growing food and sustainability and all of that type of stuff. So as I'm learning everything at the urban farm, I want to work in that field, like the landscaping type of gardening. I wanted to find a job in gardening. They actually required a degree. I didn't have a degree, but they still gave me the job because I showed my passion for it. So that's kind of how like I transitioned to that. Just wanted to just get into the field.
Now, before we jump to Taryn's college years, a lot of my listeners may not have any frame of reference for an urban farm. I mean, they might think a community garden, right? Where it's just a 8x8 plot of land. You get to plant things if you want to plant things. Mm-hmm. Is that what an urban farm is? A farm, to me, contextually sounds much more significant in size and scale. So what is an urban farm?
Well, in the case that we're talking about is like, so we're in Atlanta. Well, we're in Douglasville and Atlanta is the main city. In Atlanta, there was a guy named Nuri. He purchased 5 acres inside of Atlanta. Like it's right in the middle of the city. It wasn't that 8x8 plot. It was this 5 acre place. He had just acquired it and he needed students to just come in and free labor pretty much. Yeah. I pretty much helped him to just kind of build it up. So the urban farm was just it was a piece of land with trees. It used to be an abandoned, it used to be a motel.
Really?
It used to be a motel, but he pretty much just like converted it into this oasis of herbs and composting and worm composting and growing tomatoes and basil. And
in the middle of Atlanta.
In the middle of Atlanta. And actually, there are different places around. And this place is still going to this day, but like that's what this place was. It was no one here. It was just him. I call it like my older brother, Nuri. And then me, this young kid that's just had a passion, just wanted to just learn. It wasn't even about money. I just wanted to get in there and just learn how to like, I just wanted skills. I was listening to Jim Rohn a lot and he always talked about gain more skills. So I think that was my focus was just pick up some skills.
I love it. Love it. So Taryn, for obviously again, you and Quentin meet in college. Coming into college, you wanted something to do with journalism and you switched to public relations. Coming out of college though, what was that journey and what did you end up doing out of college?
While I was in college, I took on a job as a server. So that became my thing. It was a great way to make quick money. So I loved being a server and I was just still going to school. What deterred me from school a little bit was because I was taking journalism, public relations, and I remember taking a journalism class and the teacher telling us about propaganda. And I was like, wait a second. You know, when I learned about propaganda and fake news and how you know, you work for certain corporations and you have to deliver this news, I was like, that's not going to sit right with me. And it was just like, I wanted to be true to who I was. Not only that, but me and Quentin, we were like spending a lot of time. So it was really like us talking a lot more about different things. I was having questions as I was turning into a young adult about religion, about my whole upbringing. Like, what is life? Pretty much. I was going through that. I wanted to establish myself as a young adult. And so Quentin was really into gardening and his thought process has always been kind of like radical. So even when I'm like hanging out with him, it's like, okay, yeah, like I want to drop out of school and do this. And so when he mentioned like dropping out of school, I'm like, oh shoot, like we dropped out of school around the same time. Like we both dropped out of school around the same time. And so even then while we were in college, I had saw that flyer for the internship and I told Quentin about it. And he was the only person that responded to the internship. And we dropped out of school and I was just working, but I was just like stressed out from the day in and day out of just being a server, working in the restaurant industry. And Quinn was like, why don't you come up to the farm with me sometimes and start doing an internship too? And so that's what we started doing. And I think it was like during the summertime that we really both got into it. So like we would go to the farm during the day and then later on at night we would go to work. He was a valet at the time and I was in the restaurant industry being a server at the time. So we just learned more about farming practices. I was learning more about plants. That's where I learned about my first herb. That's where I learned about food, just even growing on a plant. I didn't even have that connection for myself growing up. I didn't kind of understand that food grew on a plant. So you know, being an intern at that farm kind of just opened up my eyes to so much, and the fact that like herbs can heal, because Nuri showed us a plant. He showed us this tall, magnificent plant. And I was like, what is that? And he was like, this is the mullein plant. It helps to open up your lungs. It helps to open up the bronchial tubes. And I was like, a plant helps to open up your lungs? Like, what? So we're learning about the power of plants. Quentin, he recommended, Nuri was like so deep into the soil. He was into this practice called biodynamics. And so Quentin started getting into that. He's got a book called Secrets of the Soil. And we just were learning about how complex growing a plant, Mother Nature, is.
The mindset shift. That's the place. The mindset shift.
That was the place. So I wanted to learn a skill.
All right, let me jump in here really quick, because Quentin and Taryn's story is about to really pick up some steam as we begin to see how their life started leading up to them starting Urban Eden. But before we get into the thick of it, I want to invite you to join Grindology. This month is our premier shipment, and you do not want to miss out on it. So what is Grindology, you might be asking? Grindology is an entrepreneurial subscription box that ships every quarter full of resources to help fuel your grind and your hustle. Each shipment delivers 2 bags of uniquely crafted coffee specifically roasted for you, the founder, the hustler, entrepreneur, maker, and creator. Each shipment also includes an exclusive mug that speaks to the unique nature that is you, the entrepreneur. And lastly, and arguably most importantly, every single Grindology shipment will include a copy of the Grindology Tactical Manual. Every single issue of Grindology will be chock full of real tactics from real business builders, not journalists. Within the pages of the Grindology Tactical Manual, we will be delivering to you tactics and strategies that you can integrate into your business immediately. How great would it be to receive real marketing funnel strategies from those who are doing it? Wouldn't it be helpful if a successful founder laid out specific user acquisition strategies that they use to grow their business? Well, those are the types of tactics that will be found in each issue of Grindology. Like I said, real tactics from real business builders. Everything about Grindology is about helping to fuel your grind. That is why our friends at Design Pickle have partnered with us for our first shipment by hooking up one lucky subscriber with a full year of unlimited graphic design services. You can visit Grindology.com to learn more. Like I said earlier, we ship our first box this month, and it will be an exclusive shipment. So make sure to secure your box today at Grindology.com. Like always, we'll include a link to Grindology.com within our show notes for easy access. Now let's get back to our episode. So my brain is going a little bit crazy right now, because that is such a complete shift from where you both started just a few years before when you were entering college. And which is why in the Startup Story, we unpack the full journey, because there are these moments where we just cut a different direction. There's something that happens to us or around us that begins to challenge the way we think and the way we process, the way we do things. And now you're both in an urban farm environment. You're understanding more about the soil and the plants, and your perspective of the circle of life, if you will, begins to open up. But were you thinking this was had something to do with your future from an income earning potential, or was this still just a hobby of some sorts? Because again, I know you had your other gigs to help provide an income, but was this all just a hobby for you at this time?
It kind of was just a hobby right at the time. And I mean, we were involved in the farmer's market culture. Like Taryn said, we were very radical. So we were thinking, oh, we're going to live on a commune. We want to get land.
Well, hold on a second. Let me say something. Taryn said, you are very radical. Let's just be very
It is me.
Let's just say what it is. Because when Taryn said that, all I thought was, oh man, I would have loved to have been there when she brought him home to meet mom.
It was really difficult. Because when we dropped out of college, like my parents were upset about that. So Quentin was the radical catalyst. And yes. I eventually adopted it as well, but he was the catalyst.
Yeah, my parents even looked at us crazy, looked at me crazy. But I was expressing to her just like, I just want to do more. Like, I felt like everyone else. You know the little picture when it shows like a person walking on a road by himself and then everyone just walking in this road? I felt like I was in that road where everybody was just going. I don't want to go down that route. So after that, like, I really wanted to monetize those skills that we learned, because we weren't making really any money. We're servers. I'm a valet. We're not making any real money. What are we going to do? So that's when I started my first business. I monetized the skills that we learned at the Urban Farm to start my first business, which was called Ruach HaKad, a landscape design and gardening business where I would install vegetable gardens in people's backyards. And it eventually kind of morphed into landscape design because the market really wasn't responding to the vegetable gardens. They really want flowers and trees in their yard.
They want the visually beautiful.
Yeah, they want beautiful stuff. Not many people have that mindset of, I want to produce food in my backyard, because we're so used to going to the store. And I completely understand that. Like, I don't think the market was completely ready. And I didn't understand marketing at that time as well.
So now you're starting to monetize the skills you're learning. What is your journey at this point in time, Taryn? Like, what are you thinking from an income earning potential with regards to the farm that you're working on? As you're seeing him starting to monetize, are you starting to think the same way, or what's going on in your life at this time?
So what's going on in my mind is I am starting to think the same way. At first, we started selling vegetables, having the connections where we were taking the vegetables to the restaurants. And then Nuri had me and Quentin selling at farmers markets. We were selling plants and vegetables. So now I'm starting to see the commerce. I'm starting to see that transaction going on. And I started to look around a farmer's market, and I had learned this skill, and I was learning how valuable of a skill farming was. And I was like, wow, I got this like farming skill, but farming is very tedious as a skill.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm looking around the farmer's market and I'm like, I want to learn how to do something so that I can have this life at the farmer's market. Like, I want to be one of these people selling my own thing at the farmer's market.
Okay.
So I was like, I want to learn a skill. And like Quentin said, we were thinking about, like, because we had went to go visit a commune that has a very popular birth center on there. I don't know if you heard of the caravan that was back in the 70s that traveled from California to Tennessee. Yeah. We went to go visit their land. And so when we went to go visit their commune that they have in Tennessee, the way that they kind of prospered was that a lot of people had businesses. That's how they told the story of how they got started. A lot of them became midwives. They had a soy company doing tofu. So to have a community, you want to have a valuable business. So I was like, okay, what skill am I going to learn to do? And I got into jewelry making. I was doing that. And I was actually like making jewelry and started selling the jewelry as well. And that was really my introduction into me doing my own personal business. And then I was like, this is not it. I want to learn how to do something more valuable. I was going through a craft book. I love to read as well. We went to Barnes & Noble, and I just picked up a craft book. And I was going through the book, and it had so many different crafts in there, but for some reason, soap making stood out to me. And I just ordered all the ingredients that it took to make that soap, and I made soap.
There we go.
Yeah, I remember that.
So now we're at this point where do we consider that moment the beginning of Urban Eden?
Yes.
That was truly the beginning of Urban Eden.
Okay, so before we unpack Urban Eden, I feel like I would be doing my listeners a disservice. Like, there's just probably this resonating question in their brain, and I don't want them to be distracted as we unpack how you built Urban Eden. But what was it about a commune living that was attractive? Because that's not how either of you grew up, especially being raised by a military dad. I mean, neither of you grew up that way. What was it about commune living that was attractive?
One thing that I kind of left out was my father has always been a researcher of religion. He's always been searching. So we came into a religion called Hebrew Israelite. It's kind of like the Black Jewish side.
Okay.
So they are very self-sufficient type and very, I would say, radical and just think differently and growing your own food. Like, they're like that.
Okay.
And we were still involved with that community at the time. So that's kind of where that mindset was thinking. And that's when she was like, hey, let's develop skills. You know what I'm saying? Because growing food for a community is like the most essential skill.
Yeah.
That's the most essential because we all got to eat. So that's kind of where that mindset stemmed from, was that religion. So when me and Taryn got married and we were dating and whatnot, she came into that way of life that I was already in since I was 13.
And let's just be real, really. I'm Baptist and food is essential. Let's just go. Whoever's got the best potluck is going to have the biggest congregation, period. Yes. Right?
So, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I get it. So now you have this landscaping business that you are building on the side. Taryn now is making soap. I assume the soap is what you took to the farmer's market.
Well, honestly, when I first started making soap, it was based off a hobby. So I literally, like I said, I wanted a skill. Even though I was thinking business, it was kind of like I still just wanted to have a skill under my belt.
Okay.
So the first batch of soap that I ever made was what we call melt and pour, where all I did was like order a base and then I put the ingredients into it.
Okay.
And so I just posted that on Facebook and I was like, y'all, look, I made soap. And people were like, oh, I want to try it. So it wasn't really, it was more like hobby. Like, I like to do this and I'm going to learn more and more about it. And then our congregation that we were involved in, that's where I started selling the soap. So before I even came up with the name Urban Eden, I just wanted to sell my soap that I was making at our congregation. So that was my introduction to actually selling. We weren't involved in the farmer's market just yet.
So at what point, again, now you have transactions on this product that stems from developing a skill as well as your time on the urban farm. Mm-hmm. So between the two of you, as discussions are taking place, who is the driving force for continuing to level up Urban Eden? Where does that come from? Because you just via Facebook, you know, among your congregation, just kind of selling it or distributing it. Mm-hmm. Then at some point you go to farmer's market. Then at some point you do something. I mean, who is the mastermind behind the continual leveling up?
Quentin. Yeah, Quentin is the catalyst. He had the first business and everything. He the one who put me on.
So then with that being said, Taryn, as you were distributing it and really just learning how to make soap and distributing among the congregation, did that put you off at all as he's wanting to, as he's starting to see ways to monetize this skill set? Were you nervous in any way, shape, or form?
No, I wasn't nervous at all because the only thing I was nervous about probably like was when we left school. But other than that, Quentin was just so like entrepreneurial minded already. Like even when I was just doing whatever I was doing with the soap, he was like, you need to start a soap business. Like he was the one who actually said that. And I was like, I was nervous. I was like, start a soap business. I was like, what does that look like? I really remember my reaction being like, what does that look like? I was like, a soap business. And he was like, you need to learn how to make the soap from scratch. That would make sense because I would want to know everything that's in it. So I was like, so then from there, I had to order a soap kit and learn how to make soap from scratch. And I had it in my mind like, okay, well, I'm going to have a business. And at first I was like, I mean, Quentin, he came along, I think like a year when we got into the online store. But for a while, I was just learning my ways, reading books about starting businesses. And Quentin was working on his business and doing internet marketing at the same time. And we didn't have a TV. We were just making soap and reading about creating an herbal body care business. That's what I was doing on my end.
So now for you, Quentin, as you were seeing her do this, your brain obviously is wanting to level up the business. As you see her distributing locally among the congregation, obviously then moving into farmer's market, where were you seeing this from a journey and trajectory?
So the crazy thing is when Taryn is explaining the story about how she's in the kitchen, the melt and pour, the soap kit, I'm in the other room learning about internet marketing. Because I'm in my first business. My first year in business was horrible. Why does no one want vegetable gardens? Well, no one knows about it. You don't create any content.
Yeah.
Now I start getting into internet marketing and start learning about content creation. I start learning about blogging and things like that. So I always had a thought in my mind, like I'm doing this service. It's taking a toll on my body. But then I'm looking at this product over here that Taryn is making. And I'm like, huh, this can be shipped. This can be sold online. We can make sales while we're asleep. Huh. This is the business right here that's going to take care of us for the long haul. I'm still doing my business and learning and things like that. It wasn't until at the end of my tenure with my landscaping business that I was just like, okay, I really want to do something different. I really wanted to get into marketing, but I'm going to leave it there.
There you go. So one of the things that with any startup is now we are in the startup phase of Urban Eden. And before we continue on, Taryn, can you unpack for my listeners what exactly Urban Eden is?
Urban Eden is an all-natural body care products company. It started with us making bar soap. Now we branch off and make liquid soap. We do facial care. We do body butters and body oils as well. That's Urban Eden. It's me loving plants. And the basis of Urban Eden is that every product that we make, it has to incorporate plants. It has to be plant-based. We only use essential oils to scent any of our products. So we don't use like synthetic fragrances. And it's really just a matter of staying true. So just even our bringing up at the farm, we just wanted to stay true to the earth. So that's what Urban Eden is for me, creating products that are allowing us to stay true to the earth. Before we even started Urban Eden, we were using like natural soaps. We were eating differently. We were trying to be more healthier inside and out.
Awesome. Now, when would you say, what year would you say is the beginning of Urban Eden?
Unofficially, it's like end of 2014, 2015. But we officially created it on paper January 1st, 2016.
But the products you were testing and distributing end of 2015.
Well, 2014. Yeah, 2014, I started making soap. In 2015, we were like distributing.
Yeah, just hobby hustling, selling it to congregation and to coworkers.
Okay, but all these things, all you know, the product, the packaging, there's cost to these things. And thus far, there isn't a tremendous amount of income opportunities that I'm seeing through the business that you were struggling with, Quentin, in the garden installations and landscape design. How did you fund this as you grew from nothing?
We still had our jobs. We were still working our jobs.
Mm-hmm. I was full-time with the landscaping business the last 2 years. So since I was able to do that, I was able to put some money in there. And then I did take out a terrible personal loan. I will never forget. I took out a terrible personal loan of like $4,000, I think. And I put that into Urban Eden and was just like, and that helped us get a lot of material and things like that, like the first start off.
And when, that was what, 2015 or so?
That was like 2016. That was like at the beginning of 2016. That's kind of when I took out like the $4,000 and I put up some money to like buy like essential oils. And I remember we bought our first drum of oil and things like that.
So in 2016, as you really started ramping up, what did 2016 look like for Urban Eden? Because now you are really starting to look at it as a business and not a hobby, not something you're just distributing among friends and family. You are looking at this as something, especially because, like you said, Quentin, as you were really getting head deep into internet marketing, you saw this is a product that we can ship and sell online. So what did 2016 look like for you from a marketing perspective, a funding of the growth, you know, if there was growth in 2016, mm-hmm. and as well as the products themselves?
Taryn was kind of doing a lot of things herself. She was doing a lot of the production herself because I was still in my landscaping business that whole 2016.
And you were doing valet.
Yeah, and I was doing valet. So like I would be gone all through the day. Taryn would be at home and she would be doing the production, doing all of that stuff. In terms of marketing,
I worked too. I was a server at a restaurant.
But remember, you were only a server from January like to the like beginning. March. Yeah, yes. Then we got into farmers markets. And our physical sales outperformed the online sales. We didn't really have any online sales. But one of the things that we did and we stayed true with was we collected data at these farmers markets. Every time we made a transaction, we were collecting a number and an email and a name. We always did that, even if it was only a few hundred for the entire year. We stayed doing that and we stayed emailing and communicating. Taryn was controlling the social media then as well. In terms of numbers, the first year of 2016, we only did $15,000 in revenue that entire year. And majority of that was physical sales at the farmer's market.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Mm-hmm. And so now that at the end of 2016, are you still thinking, I'm going to ask this question to Taryn. Are you still thinking that there's some legs to this business and it can grow? Or are you like, man, we busted our tail for a year and only generated $15,000? Like, what were you thinking at this time? Because I know Quentin's just like, we're about to scale. Like, this is going to be crazy. I'm sure he's probably thinking like big, 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 right? I want to know what you were thinking though, Taryn.
Because it was something I was passionate about as far as making soap, I felt like we were going to still continue to go on. And we were really starting to pick up traction because we were making the activated charcoal soap and tea tree and turmeric soap. So when I was doing my research and development for even the products that I was coming out with, I was trying to figure out like what's hot right now. So a lot of people were picking up on, oh, I like this activated charcoal and it's tea tree and turmeric. And we were getting good responses from the farmers market, even though it wasn't like the best. And you know, we struggled. We were like, dang, do we need to go? I quit my job. I was like, do we need to go back after a while? But 2017 is really when it got tough for us. 2016, it was like, okay, we're going to keep on doing this. 2017, we were questioning.
So what happened 2017?
At the end of 2016, because we were in Destin, which we do a Destin trip pretty much every other year. And we were in Destin. I was having a talk with a subscription box. And she was like, yeah, we want to put in an order for 4,000 bars of soap. And I was like, huh? Well, she found us through Instagram, first and foremost. Yeah. She found us through Instagram. She tried out the activated charcoal soap. So that was our driving force, truly. She was like, I really love this soap and I want to order 4,000 of this particular soap. I want to get 4,000 bars of the activated charcoal soap. And when I first did the deal, I was thinking, I usually don't tell this side of the story. Quentin tells this, but I'm like,
when you first told me about the deal, you're saying?
Yes, when I first told him about the deal, I was like, she's going to buy all 4,000 bars for at retail price. And he was like, what? She is? I was like, yeah, she is.
I didn't believe it. I did not believe it.
So then I talked to her again. And of course, she did not buy it at retail price. Actually, she bought it even below the price that we made it. But because we were kind of like in a position where we really wanted the opportunity, even though we didn't really have any money in the business, we just saw it as an opportunity to be in a subscription box where we were going to be reaching out to 4,000 people that we weren't reaching out to on our own. Yeah. And throughout our whole span of ever making soaps, our years of being in business, we had never made 4,000 bars in totality. Mm. So that was a new, we had never done that. I didn't know how I was going to do it. I want to take this on because I saw it as a really big opportunity for us to kind of just market a little bit more and create a brand partnership. That brand was actually more noted than we were as well. They had a lot of people that were using their subscription box.
I mean, that's the beauty of subscription box is the discovery side of it, right? For brands to be discovered. But what was the downside of that for you guys?
Like she said, it was a good thing for exposure, but the downside was that it's a brand partnership. They labeled it as this is a brand partnership. So we're only going to buy the bars at $1. Now, we're selling the bars at $6 at the time. Okay. So I'm like, $1? We had to just sit and think like, okay, let's still do this. So basically the downside of it is that it wasn't a profitable deal by any stretch of the imagination. But the thing is that they were going to front us half of the money up front. So they front us half of the money up front so we can buy materials to start producing it.
Yeah.
Another downside was that deal, even though she started talking with them at the end of 2016, we didn't finalize the deal until February, March.
And we had 6 weeks to fulfill it.
And again, we had never produced 4,000 bars ever. Yeah. And at the time, we were going through it very hard financially, very hard.
About to find jobs prior to that.
Taryn was actually about to find a job. She did get hired. The day you got hired, they called you back and was like, hey, we want to do the deal.
And I called the job back like, I'm not going to do it because I got 6 weeks to make 4,000 soaps.
Yep. So fast forward, like we produced the soaps and because this was our first deal, I didn't negotiate shipping, anything. Like I was so green in this. I didn't negotiate shipping. I didn't even negotiate anything. It was just like they gave us the deal and we just said yes. And at this point in time today, if we ever heard that deal again, we'd be like, no, absolutely not. But that deal really set our online store to really go off because our soap is getting exposed to 4,000 people. We didn't have any money for shipping. We actually ran out of money towards the end of producing this. So I look at Taryn, I was like, hey, we honestly don't even have any money for shipping. How are we going to get it to them?
So you were able to produce the 4,000 bars in a very fast period of time, which you've never done before. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious how you accomplished that. But then once you did produce all those, you didn't have a way to get it to wherever they needed to be.
Nope, we didn't.
So the way that we did this, to answer your question about how we produced it, shout out to our mentor, Craig. He used to do some woodworking. So what he did was we stayed up literally all night and he literally helped us like 5X our production. We was only like making 100 bars at a time.
Because we only had like 7 molds to start with.
So he helped us produce a lot more molds ourselves. So we went to Home Depot, got the wood cut, and we stayed up all night putting together these molds. So then we went from 100 bars at a time to making like over 500 bars in one session. So we were able to knock that out and produce these bars.
Okay.
So that helped to increase our production. We were creating bigger batches after that.
So how did you raise money for the shipping then?
So as far as raising money for the shipping, so I told Taryn, I said, hey, I remember this night. We were at the Urban Farm. I said to her, I said, hey, what if we drove the soap there?
To where? Where did it need to be?
In LA. And we're in Atlanta. So I said, hey, what if we rent a vehicle and we drive it there?
The Radical.
We only had like a few days left to get it there. Yeah. And it wasn't going to make it there in time. And then at the time, I didn't know about third-party logistics where it could be cheaper than going through USPS and them. I didn't know about that. All I was thinking was, man, I got to pack 20-something boxes, ship it USPS. It's going to cost like $1,200. We didn't have $1,200. I was like, all right, let's do a video. Let's do a GoFundMe. I literally took my phone. I said, Taryn, let's ask them for the money. I shot a video of her and we literally raised $4,000 in 2 days.
And Quentin really spearheaded a lot of that. As he said, he even had the idea. He was like, okay, so let's go through and go through our Facebook messages and personally message everybody that we know on Facebook Messenger. And that was how we were able to get that money in like 2 to 3 days, because these people that we were personally, that we would have conversations with them. Yeah. Not only that, but Quentin, his big motto throughout it all is document the journey.
So we documented it.
So we have been documenting the whole process of, y'all, we got a 4,000 bar order. Y'all, we've been staying up late at night making soap, waking up early in the morning. My thumbs hurt. Showing everything. We've been showing everybody everything. Mm-hmm. So they've been along with us through the process and gave money to us.
So when we asked for the money, it wasn't like, oh, what you need the money for? They already knew because we were going live. We were showing everything. So when we asked for the money, they gave it to us quickly. We were able to rent a vehicle. We were able to have money for gas, food.
Bring an extra person with us, the extra driver. Mm-hmm.
And we literally drove it across the country in 36 hours. Delivered it by hand.
And came back.
Got to meet the people and had enough money to make it back to Atlanta.
Yes.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
That was the best moment. Out of everything in our whole entire journey, that was the best experience of my life.
That was the most, yes.
Now, in my mind, I can assume why that might be, but why do you consider that to be just a remarkable moment for your journey?
The thought, like, for example, when I was at the Urban Farm, I was like, hey, what if we drove it there? And then I actually executed on it, and we did that. You know, being able to drive across the country, I never drove across the country. So seeing America is absolutely beautiful. It's beautiful. And being able to see that, traveling and seeing new things, it brings up like new thoughts and new experiences. And you can conjure up just new things. Like, I think just the experience of it. And we were young. How old were we at the time? Like 25, I think.
2017. Yeah,
25. We were just young and ambitious, and it wasn't about the money, because again, we didn't make any money on this deal. Like, we didn't make any money, but the fact that we were exposed to all these people. So after the deal was done, I start seeing the reviews coming in. I start seeing the reviews of, hey, we got your soap in the Onyx box. Hey, we got this soap in the Onyx box. I love it. And people start coming back to the online store, shopping with us. And that's when I start seeing the growth and the uptick start to come up.
And even in the farmer's market, we were having people coming up to us like, that lived in Atlanta, and they were like, I tried your soap in the Onyx box and found out you guys were here in Atlanta, saw you on Instagram and saw y'all did the farmer's market, had to come find you guys in person. So we were seeing some good results as far as that was concerned.
That's incredible. You know, one of the things that we learned during this process with the GoFundMe is that you've been documenting the journey. And obviously, I mean, there's lots of people that talk about the idea of documenting everything and using video and telling your story. For a majority of entrepreneurs, there is this block to wanting to do that until they have something to show for it. Why was that not a block for you? Because especially when you said 2016, that was a rough year. You were guys were getting jobs. I mean, I don't think anyone wants to hold up their phone documenting an IG story. Hey guys, it's really hard. We're about to go get a JOB because this ain't working. Like, how did you still maintain this idea of documenting everything despite the numerous challenges you were having?
I think, and shout out to Gary Vee. I think Gary Vee was one of the ones that really helped me, because people struggle is, what do I post? What content do I create? I don't know if you know that post where he talked about don't create, document. That actually is easy. So at the end of a day, or maybe in the midst of our day, all I would say to Taryn, what happened? That's the content. What happened? And we would just show that. So that was a way of us trying, that kept us consistent in our content and our posting. We just communicated with our customers as if they were like investors almost. That's how we were just doing it. We were just communicating them like they were family, just letting them know everything. So that's kind of what got us through that. And it stemmed from that first business as well, because I did a lot of documenting in that first business. So I took a lot of those things I was doing in that first business and applied them to this product-based business. And as you can see, it produced a lot more results.
Were there moments where you're like, I don't want to document. This is too embarrassing. This is too challenging. This is going to make us look bad. Were there moments where you're just like, I don't want to hit record?
I was the only one that ever felt like that. Quentin always had to push me. Actually, one of our videos that really went, that a lot of people noticed, it went really...
Yeah, I remember that.
Was, okay, one time we didn't really have any money. And we didn't know how we were going to pay the rent. We was like, we got to go out to some salons, some beauty salons and barbershops and go sell the soap.
Door to door.
And so... it was Quentin's idea. Quentin was like, we need to make some money. So Quentin was like, okay, now it's your turn to go up to this one salon and go in there and sell. And I was so nervous, but he was recording me being nervous about going in there. And he was like, he's in the video saying, just go in there, you'll be all right, go in there. And I was like, you can see my hesitation, like I don't want to go in there. But so many people love to see that transparency and that vulnerability and see that they thought that, because you know, they see us as successful on that. So they're like, wait a second, like you were scared too to go sell your product? You know, showing that, and that honestly gave me confidence, like being able to show those vulnerable times and people actually like reaching out and being like, you know, you inspired me through that vulnerable time and showed me like, it's not all peaches and cream. They love to see that.
And to give you numbers, 2017, we end up growing to 68,000 in that year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we went from 15K in 2016, and then the end of 2017, we end up doing $68,000 in sales that year. So it was a good year. In terms of the growth.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, numerically, not just revenue, but units and customers. I mean, there's lots of things that are now starting to work in your favor from the marketing perspective. 2018 happens. What does 2018 look like for you from a numbers perspective?
So 2018, we did 108,000. So if you ask me about all of our years, I would say this is our worst year. And the only reason why I would say this is our worst year, because this is when I learned that personal expenses really kind of got in the way that year. Me and Taryn were living on our own in a house, because what we forgot to mention was that in the early part of Urban Eden, we moved back with our parents. And that 2015, before we officially created it, we moved back with our parents to try to figure out what we're going to do and things like that. So 2018, we were out on our own. We were living in a house. And I really felt like personal expenses were killing us. Even though it was a more consistent year, I think we were probably doing around like $8,000 a month on average. And we did $108,000. So in terms of growth, we did grow. Yeah. But we didn't grow like I expected to. Because our Q4 of 2017 was bigger than any quarter of 2018.
So you just played that out in Excel and like, okay, we're going to have a $250,000 year in 2017. And it didn't get there. Got it.
Yep, it didn't. But again, it was more consistent, but it just, if your Q4 of 2017 is bigger than all of your quarters in 2018, it's just like, yeah, what happened, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's walk through the years, because 2020, while it was a challenging year for most businesses, it was a tremendous year, although there were challenges with it as well, but it was a tremendous year for Urban Eden. So 2017, you had said you did about 108,000, I think you said, for the year.
Oh, 2018.
108,000. What was 2019?
2019 was 263.
At 2020, what did that year end up for you?
It ended 2.7 million.
What happened? That is remarkable growth. That's like Inc's fastest type of growth. Like that's like, you know, that arguably might be in like the top 500 of the 5,000 list if it gets there, right? So what took place in 2020 that worked so well for you?
At the end of 2019, Q4 of 2019, we did 100 grand in Q4. So at the end of 2019, I'm like, okay, we really got to like step it up. I really want to go into, because we only projected in 2020 to do 600K. Because to go from 263, we were like, hey, if we hit 600K, that's a good year based on the trajectory of all the other years. So I'm like, hey, 600K, that's good. So we got to run paid ads. We never was really running paid ads at all in any of those years.
So up to this point, word of mouth, remarketing in your emails that you're capturing, the subscription box had a nice boost for you. Other maybe partnerships come along, but no paid ads, organic search and just word of mouth stuff.
Only paid ads we really was run like, we end up getting a brick and mortar in 2019 just for production. And then we turned a little bit in the front to a store. But we did it for our grand opening. I ran ads for that, for the grand opening. But other than that, I really wasn't strategically really running them like how you're really supposed to do it. Like commit to a budget every month and scaling them up incrementally. Yeah. So in 2020, we started off January. We started off with a budget of $2,000 for ads. We also hired a videographer. So we said, hey, we really want consistent content. Like we really want to have a videographer with us to document everything and to really just be with us.
So you went, this is amazing to me. You end 2019 at 200 and something thousand dollars in revenue. And at that point you're like, now we're going to dedicate $2,000 in paid ads. I assume most of it Facebook, but you might've done some Google, but either
Facebook,
way,
Facebook, IG.
Yeah. So paid ads, and you're going to hire someone dedicated to creating video content. Like you were going all in at this point.
Absolutely. Cause I said, hey, and the crazy thing is that through 2019, we were living with our parents. We were doing, you know, like I said, we ended off the Q4 of 2019 at 100K for that quarter, still living with my parents. We had no expenses. We kept those expenses super low. Cause remember 2018, I learned that personal expenses could really kill your business.
Yeah.
So I said, you know what? Let's just take a step back. Let's really be all in. Because if we really want this business to really be for us and really take care of us long term, we got to go all in. So we committed to ads budget. We commit to a videographer, and COVID hits. The protests, you know, the George Floyd stuff, and people really wanted to just support Black businesses. And what was that other thing, Taryn? Oh, COVID, protests, and ads. I think the mix of all of that.
And our brand story had got released during that.
We came out with a brand story video that did like 3 million views. And that really was like the perfect storm. So like to give you context, like in January, we were doing like 30K in revenue. February, we did 38K. March, we went up to 63K. April, we went to 100K. May, we went to 200K. June, we was at 300K. So it was just, it was growing so much And I know we'll probably talk about the mental side and the stress side of that, but like when I say this was so unbelievable, I literally was trying to stop the sales and people were still just ordering.
Obviously that type of growth, especially unplanned for,
mm-hmm.
probably just did a toll on both you individually, your marriage, your finances, your plan, like all of that, your customer service probably became issues. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, that is tremendous growth that you had mm-hmm. not planned for in any way, shape or form. Again, I think a lot of people are probably listening, thinking like, well, that's a problem I'd like to try and figure out and solve. And I'm sure it is a problem we would all like to try and figure out and solve. But for you being in the midst of that, trying to stop the machine, what was happening in your world that was so bad that you wanted to stop the sales?
The way that I was trying to stop the sales is that we actually were getting back. So we produce all of our products in-house. We produce everything in-house. And because we do it, I think that gave us a little bit of advantage because we produce everything in-house. So at first I was like, hey, it's a week fulfillment time. Then I would bump it out 1 to 2 weeks. Then I would do 2 to 3 weeks. I was literally trying to stop the orders by the fulfillment time. It got all the way up to 4 to 6 weeks. I was like, hey, I'm going to put it at 4 to 6 weeks, Taryn. I think people will stop ordering then. Just because we kind of needed a pullback. But at the same time, I wanted that revenue to keep coming in because it was actually fueling the growth.
It's cash flow.
I mean, it's cash flow. We were able to hire because pre-COVID, we only had like 2 or 3 employees. After all of it was said and done, right now we're at like 35 plus employees.
Unbelievable.
And then we end up getting a warehouse in between of that. So that's a lot of expenses. So we had to have that money come in. We didn't have any loans or any investors. We really needed that money. So I just said, hey, I'm going to put 4 to 6 weeks out. So by having people wait 4 to 6 weeks, that allowed us to have this capital to be able to fuel our growth. It almost was bad. Like, I'm not even going to lie. Like, it was a customer service nightmare. That's when we hired a customer service person. And Taryn, I don't know if you want to speak about just kind of like that whole mental thing that you were kind of going through. And of course, me as well.
Yeah, we were both definitely going through it mentally. Our marriage was actually doing great because the fact that we had each other and we both knew what we were going through, that helped us a lot to be able to have each other to kind of be like, okay, we're in this together.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really difficult because all those years prior to that, we never had any fulfillment issues. We were getting orders mm-hmm. out really quickly. Our product quality was great. Everything was looking yeah. good. I was just used to praises. That's all I was used mm-hmm. to was yeah. good comments. So then when all of that started happening with the fulfillment time going on forever, we started encountering more like negative. I'm disappointed. I've been a customer with mm-hmm. you guys. And it was really taking like an emotional toll on me because I felt like, you know, this is my product. Like I put my love. Yeah, this yeah. is my baby. Yeah. So to start to see that it was like, it was suffering. It was just like, you know, I felt like it was like a weight on my whole just world. And I was trying to like get out of this hole. And it was just like more dirt just kept coming in. Like mm-hmm. when I'm trying to get out the hole. But like Quentin said, the customer service, us hiring somebody for customer service literally saved my life, like my mental mm-hmm. life, because it was becoming too much because I was finding myself, I do research and development for the business. No new products hardly came out this year whatsoever. I wasn't able to do any research, no development. I was in fulfillment. I'm over here trying to figure out fulfillment, getting the orders out. That was my priority. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure we got the orders out.
Are you still manufacturing the product? I mean, you, Taryn, not the company. I know the company still does it all, but are you still part of the manufacturing?
I'm a part of the manufacturing process. So I create, and for 2021, I'm trying to create more products as well. But we do have I have a production team, but I do lead the team.
One of the things that I find interesting about this moment where it just became overwhelming because of the growth, in most marriages, both people are not the co-founders of some brand. They're not working in it together. And I'm going to speak honestly, as a male, I don't bring a lot of my challenges home.
Mm-hmm.
I shield my wife and my kids from the challenges of the day, the cash flow challenges, whatever the case may be,
mm-hmm.
because I've mentally programmed myself that I got to just figure it out. This isn't their burden to carry. I just got to figure this out. So if I were to do that alongside my wife, it'd be very hard for me to keep that, I'm going to say that warrior front up as I'm trying to figure it out, because she's seeing that I don't have an answer for any of this. What mm-hmm. was it like for you, Quentin? Or is that mm-hmm. just a non-issue for you?
Man, no, like you're so right. Like mm-hmm. crazy thing, and Taryn know the story I'm about to go to, like we went to Portland. So like one weekend, we just had to get away. Because it was probably like in July, we had to get away for a weekend. At that point, I think we had like probably 20 employees at that time. So we were able to just kind of like just step away just for a weekend. Man, so I went on the back porch of this Airbnb we rented out in Portland, and I just broke down crying. I just broke down like, I don't think, Taryn, I don't know if you ever even seen me cry like that. Like,
I had never saw you cry like that before.
And the reason why I did that, it was just that I felt so much pressure. When I say it was so much pressure, it's because it's like, we were like backed up by like 5,000-6,000 orders. You can't stop. I remember I was consulting with my mentor. I was just like, man, like, can I shut all this down? He was just like, no, you can't shut this down at all. You can't. He was like, I had a restaurant. And when it got busy, you can't shut down. Like, what do you mean? It's just the first time of going through all of this. And I remember telling myself before all of this happened, I was like, man, we need another 4,000 bar moment that's going to stretch us to grow. But I nowhere near knew that it would be like this.
Yeah.
So it's like I asked for it. But man, like, that's why I tell people, be careful what you ask for, because it just might come. And just the pressure, man, like, and I think that after I cried, I literally felt so light. You know, as men, like you said, we have to hold it in. We really have to be like this brick wall because we have to be strong. You know, we really have to be strong. So I think just really being able to be vulnerable in front of her like that. And like, I remember she consoled me or whatever, but that moment of just me just letting it out was just so good for me. I don't think we could have did this without each other.
You know, let me ask you a question, Taryn, and I'm asking this because I want all of the co-founders who are married couples that are listening, and I don't know how many I have. I know 55% of my audience is male. So from a demographic perspective, let's assume half of that 55% are married. When you saw Quentin just break down, as your co-founder especially, as someone who's a partner with you in growing this business, when you saw him break down in Portland, did that elevate any area of concern for you? Like, oh crap, like maybe there isn't a solution to all these challenges we're going through at this very moment.
No, it really didn't make me feel like there wasn't a solution. I felt like that we had it in the bag. I had to reassure Quentin. I just was like, we're in this together. We're good. We're going to make it through this. And anytime that I've ever had any tribulations in my life, what's always gotten me through was looking to better days and knowing that they're going to come regardless. And so that's what I knew, even though I felt like this was a storm that we were in, and we were pretty much, I knew that we were going to come through the storm. So that it was just that reassurance. But you know how you're, when you're in the midst, we both had our moments. The good thing was that we never had our moments really at the same time. Our moments were at different times. So that's why we were able to be strong for each other in that moment whenever the other person felt a little bit weaker.
I'm so thankful that you answered that question, because I wanted my male audience to hear that our wives do not think less of us when we have those vulnerable moments.
That's big.
They too want to come alongside us and help us, you know, whether it be co-founders or not. We don't need to keep this mask up, this persona that we just got it all figured out, because I'm going to be frank, for my 45% female listeners, we don't got to figure it out, but you already know we don't got to figure it out. So I appreciate you sharing that moment.
That's real.
So one of the things about that season, now looking back, a ton of learning, right? And we're all, myself and the listeners, we're like, man, 10x growth in a year. That's amazing. Especially a year that killed so many businesses. Like, what an incredible opportunity. We heard about the challenges you went through and how, what a struggle it was for you to navigate that. So now looking back, for all of us that are wanting to experience a 10x growth in a year, what are some learnings you had that we should be preparing right now so then we get to that 10x moment, we're prepared for it?
To prepare for moments like that, like, get your stuff set up now. Go all in and invest before. Because the thing is, one of the things that we struggled with was just, it's almost like we were playing catch up the whole time. We implemented our customer service person in the midst of it. So it's like, get your customer service person implemented before, so that when things do, because customer service is everything. Amazon knows this, all of the big dogs know this. Like, you gotta have that customer service implemented before. Also, investments into the softwares before. We end up, like, after like a lot of the storm hit, we start and invested into like a better CRM system. The one that we invested into was called Rich Panel or whatnot. So it's similar to like Amazon's, where people can come on your site, they can track their own orders, because that's most of the emails. Most of the emails are, hey, where's my order? And things like that. So we implemented a system where it would actually like kind of automate a lot of that. So I would say invest into your systems, invest into people, put the people in place, hire from top down. The thing is that once we were going through the midst of this, we were just trying to find people. Hey, just come in. Like, we just need help just filling in the orders or whatnot. But it's like, hey, and it's going to take some money and it will take some sacrifice, but do your best to try to do things before. Lay that foundation before, because it's going to be so valuable for you. Because again, for us, I'm pretty sure we lost some customers. But we gained a whole lot. We gained way, way more. But we could have performed way better if we were prepared, a little bit more prepared, and had systems in place before. So in addition to everything I said, let's go into like logistics. Some of the things that I learned just through operations were ordering, you know, the material, making sure you have, honestly, like the standard now is it has to be like 6 months. You have to order for like 6 months now. Like, that's just the norm now. Like,
is that because of your volume or is that because of COVID?
That's because of COVID, I would say. Yeah. That it has to be because of COVID. And also too, like all of us, especially in the startup story, just listen to it. We're startups. So we are growing. So prepare for that growth. So get 6 months plus of material. Hmm. Order way more than you have to, because you rather have that on hand. Because again, who knows? Like, it used to be things that would only take like a few days to get to us, but it would take way longer. And then that would consequently back up orders because you're just missing like one little thing, you know, and that would back up lots of orders. Another thing also is to try to do as much as you can in-house, if you can. Hmm. Because outsourcing, as we all saw, like that made us a lot vulnerable. So I'm not here to say that, you know, you can't get things overseas and things like that. But if you can, try to find as many local vendors, try to find as many vendors that are in the States.
Yeah.
Because think about how much leverage that gives you. The fact that we were able to like put our fulfillment at 4 to 6 weeks, we were only able to do that because we produce everything in-house. So try to be as in-house as much as you can, because that's going to benefit you. And that's going to allow you to probably take more risk. Because again, if you're outsourcing your product overseas or whatnot, historically, it might have only taken you 4 weeks to get your product. But with COVID and all these special things, it might take 6 months. It might take 4 to 6 months to get, when historically it might have only took a month. So just try to beef up your internal, really cultivate that, and really just make sure that you are this well-powered machine that's just ready for this growth. Because I think 2021, it's going to be another storm, I think, that's ahead of us, that's coming. And I think that we all need to be prepared for it. When all this growth is coming, you're just like, I'm just trying to satisfy these customers, get these orders out. Yeah. We're just trying to survive. This year was all about surviving because so many businesses died.
Yes, so many did. So many did. Part of the narrative that contributed to the growth that you experienced in 2020 was the elevation of supporting Black-owned businesses. Prior to this moment in 2020, did you feel as though it was an uphill climb as a Black business owner to gain awareness for what it is you were doing?
I would say, yeah, it's a little bit of an uphill battle, just, you know, just a lack of knowledge. We don't have like all of the knowledge in this world. We don't have a lot of representation for investment and things like that. And just having people in our network to just go to, just to be like, hey, have you had a $1 million business or whatnot so you can come and help me? So there's not many people within our network that we can just go to that look like us to be like, hey, can you help us with this? But at the same time, like, it's also an advantage because it's almost like that underdog type of thing, that David and Goliath type of thing. Yeah. It's something that we can play off of. And now people are looking to support these businesses now. Like, that's the first question people ask us in the inbox. Hey, is this a Black-owned business? It's not something that we just supermarket, because I mean, we're just being ourselves.
Yeah.
And we happen to be Black.
That's awesome. That's incredible. You know, one of my past episodes, I think it was Nasa Mishler with the Everest Effect. One of the things that she talked about when it came to how she wants to support the underrepresented when it comes to venture capital, you know, one of the things she said was, if you can't see it, you can't be it. Mm-hmm. And that has always stuck with me since, because the Startup Story is really focused on trying to elevate the female founder story, because in venture capital, that is a huge miss. And the gender bias in venture capital for female-founded companies is unbelievable. But I will also say too, earlier in 2020, when everything started elevating the awareness of Black-owned businesses, I had to look at my entire roster of past episodes and realize I'd been so focused on elevating female founder stories that I realized I only had one Black founder on my show at that point in time. And it's like, wait a second here. How is that even possible? But what I also find interesting is that since June, as I've really focused to try and tell more Black founder stories, it is so hard to book Black founders. And I don't know if it's because, I don't know if it's because I'm as a white podcaster, I don't know what it is. So I was running a live event in June, a live stream event. And, you know, the comments on Instagram were like, you know, wait, really no black founders on the roster? And I had like 13, I had 13 founders.
Yeah.
But I did have Denise Woodard of Partake Foods. She's half Asian, half black. And they overlooked it in that comment. But I actually invited them into a Zoom to discuss.
Yeah.
And they both were surprised by it. But I even told them, I said, look, like I have a hard time getting female founders on because females, they think they have to reach a certain level of success for their story to be worth telling. Mm-hmm. Like guys will talk about ourselves all day long. Like guys have no problem talking about themselves. Like we could have done nothing and we will talk as though we are experts at something. Like for females, that's not the case. Like there's something that has to take place in their startup for them to feel their story is worth it. And I told them the same thing. Like I can't get black founders on the show. Like, you know, my acceptance rate from black founder, despite the fact of the awareness I can bring, the audience I could drive, like all the things, like one of the things that one of the ladies said to me was, well, I can't speak to why you can't get black founders. Like, but I would just ask that when you do get black founders, don't try to be a savior to the black businesses. I'm like, that is not even like, is that like the fact that was even a thought? Yeah, I was like, is that a thought in, as I approach, now you approached me, which was great, but like, had I approached you, would there be any filter whatsoever as to why you may or may not want to be on a show?
Oh no, I honestly, like, I listen to like, it's crazy. Do you know the Shopify unofficial podcast?
Yeah.
I was on there and like, I'm actually good friends with Kurt Elster now. Like, I like all these different podcasts. I like business. Like, I like to hear stories. Like, even earlier, like, I was always listening to just different people's stories, like, of all various races. Just, I'm not going to say I don't see color, but like, I'm into business and entrepreneurship. Like, it's so, I learn from everybody.
The mentor that you were even mentioning,
Craig. Mentor,
Craig is not, he's not black.
So he's not just, black, yeah.
And Nuri's like mixed, but it's just like all the people that have interacted. And even when we started Urbanita, my aunt came to me and she was like, don't just sell to black people. And I'm like, what? Like, what are you talking about? Yeah. Don't just, like, that was never our intention whatsoever. It's like Quentin said, it's about business and how do we develop personally and through business. And it doesn't matter how that happens. Even investors that are looking at us, the first set of investors that are looking at us are not black.
Yeah. And they even said out their mouth, like, we didn't think that you would even talk to us because they, we were white. And we were like, and the thing is, to your point, we actually have been, because, you know, a lot of businesses now, like we were in talks with Sephora, and a lot of businesses now are trying to commit.
And Nordstrom, too.
They're trying to commit 15% of their shelf space to black-owned businesses. But they even said, too, they having a hard time with finding those black businesses is just because a lot of us, like, we can't handle that.
Right.
We can't fulfill that. And that's our biggest thing right now is we need to scale. We need to really grow so that we can take on these opportunities. Because right now, our business, it's ready to go 8-9 figures. It is ready to go there. But we have to get a lot of things internally right. You know, we definitely need capital, but our business is ready to take off. It's ready.
That's incredible. And now that we've had that discussion, I am going to pull pieces from that discussion of the episode. That is a conversation that needs to be had.
That was a conversation that needed to be had.
That's a great conversation.
That is a discussion people need to be had, because as you promote your episode, I assume there will be black founders that are going to listen to it. And so they need to hear this, you know,
because absolutely.
I think there's something. And again, while I identify female founders as having this metric of success before they'll share their story, I think it's probably the same in a lot of demographics. Just men in general will just talk about them stories like it's no big deal. But I think everyone has, they look for some type of metric to where they say, I have something to contribute. I don't care what size the business is. I mean, that's not true. I do care somewhat the size of the business. I mean, if you just have an idea on a napkin, you're not going to be on the show. But you have to have done something. As we do get to the end of our time together, you've had a remarkable year in 2020. What does 2021 look like for you, especially being that you've just talked about how there's opportunities in big box retail because, you know, they're wanting to support more black-owned businesses. You're being approached for it. You got to solve the fulfillment side of it. What does 2021 look like for you?
One of the things that we're trying to focus on is, of course, just committing to more channels, just more channels. We really focused on Facebook and IG. We did YouTube and TikTok, but I really want to go in on YouTube and TikTok a lot more. Amazon is a play that we're doing. We're going to sell like some of our samples on Amazon at a higher price to try to get some of that traffic from Amazon to our site. Of course, wholesale. So the thing is, we're direct to consumer. We have not done any wholesale this entire time, except for that subscription box. So we're looking at strategic, some big box retail. We're really looking at that, but we really got to just fix a lot of our internal production issues. It's just, we need space. Right now, we're in a 6,300 square foot warehouse and we're busting out of it. So we need about a 20, 25,000 square foot warehouse right now. So that's something that we're working on. We're in talks with investors right now. We're adding things to our internal team, just making the right hires. We're still in a mode of laying foundation, just like those other years. We're still like, this is not a time where we're like, we're relaxing and we're letting up. Like, we still have so much work to do because 2020 showed us so many glaring holes in our business that we have to continue to fix. And we have to continue because people now look at us as like, oh, you're so successful. And like, yes, we are successful, but as the person that's in it, we're looking at it like, man, we still have a lot to improve.
Yeah.
Just so we got to just continue to get better. Like, we got to work on our left hand, you know what I'm saying? Like, we've been dribbling with that right hand. We got to work on our left hand, you know?
Do you see this as something that you sell to a larger brand, or is this a legacy company where you continue on for decades?
That is honestly still up in the works.
That's the question of the year.
Yes, that is honestly. But as we talk to investors, that's not what investors are pretty much looking for. They don't want to have, you know, the legacy. They want you to, you know, sell it at some point. So it's still up in the air. After this year, though, it was really a lot. It's been a lot with Urban Eden. It's been so much. And me and Quentin don't have kids right now. So, you know, at some point we want to start a family, too. So it's like, and we both work heavily in the business. So at some point, you know, I kind of want to slow down a little bit and be able to help foster the home life while Quentin, Quentin to me is like a serial entrepreneur. Like he said, he's passionate about business. So I can kind of see him either like doing something else.
I can see us being acquired by like a bigger brand. I can see that. I've actually was doing research with just with Unilever, which is Unilever is the biggest of the biggest. Mm-hmm. And the brands that they're looking for, they're looking for brands that are the natural, the essential oils. They're looking for the brands that are online based.
That have a community of people.
That have a community. They're looking for that. And our business is literally that.
Yeah.
It's there and going in that direction.
We had Jamie Schmidt on the show earlier in 2020. Her story in 7 years from making her deodorants in her kitchen, 7 years later, sells to Unilever. So her story is remarkable. Mm. Yeah, so Unilever definitely wants to be in that space.
Yeah, that's what they want. Like, and just to bring this up, like in our community, especially with the black people,
community,
they look at that as
being a sellout.
A sellout, and they look at that as a bad thing, but they don't understand that we just talked about this whole entire story. Like, they don't understand how founders start with nothing. Mm. And you build a brand from nothing to millions and millions of dollars. So if a company happens to acquire you, that should be celebrated rather than they demean it and they talk down on it. They don't understand the mental toll that it takes on a person. Man, like it's a lot mentally. And I think people just look at the outside and they don't understand what's really going on internally.
Why do you think it is looked down as a sellout, as I'm using air quotes?
Yeah.
Because I would think in this idea of you got to see it to be it, the black community would want to see more black success stories like that. Why is there this turning of the nose and snubbing it as selling out?
Because the bigger brands are not owned by black people. So that's why it's being sought as a sold out. It's like we started these businesses and then we're selling it not back to black people.
Yeah.
But to our thing, we see it as like, even if you, who are we looking at? Sundial. Sundial, I think, is that the guy who they were saying?
Shea Moisture. Sellout?
Shea Moisture, yes. He did Shea Moisture and Sundial. And now him and his mom are set for life. Like, as far as millions, like, that's creating a legacy. Like, you could continue on and do other things and invest into other things. They just see it as like, boom, you just gave up your business and it's over and done with. And
it doesn't have to be that, because the thing is, what I've learned, and the potential investors have even told us, even if you do get acquired, there are ways you can structure that deal where you can still be involved. You could still have ownership. You're just selling parts of the equity. That's really it. And speaking about Sundial, they were acquired for $850 million. Think about that. If you're acquired for $850 million, he actually went and purchased Essence, which is a huge festival and
magazine
that's in the black community. Yep. Look what he was able to acquire. And also he started a venture capital firm as well. If I was to make a pretty nice 9-figure exit, I would start some type of venture capital to support founders that look like me and things like that.
Yes.
That's a win.
Yes. Huge win. And that's why
a win.
That's the stuff that's why I look at this idea of calling them sellouts. Like, elevate more of those stories. Get more of those success stories. One, get more of those success stories achieved, and then get more of those success stories told. Because I'm willing to bet also that there are thousands and tens of thousands of successful Black started companies that did have an exit that maybe never made the headline because it was only like they sold for $40 million instead of $400 million. But no one knows those stories.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's find these stories, tell these stories so that people can see it so they can be it.
It's a lack of understanding. Even when the stories are told, it's just still a lack of understanding because a lot of people don't understand the details that go into it. They just see it as this person sold their business.
They don't understand business. That's all it is. I mean, people are going to say things, so you can't get too caught up in it. And
we learn more about it the more we talk to investors and saw how that actually looked. That's when we were able to learn more about it as well. This is not things that are taught to us by our parents. Like I said, we don't have entrepreneurs around us.
Yeah. Oh, man. I cannot wait to hear how the audience responds to your episode. It has been incredibly rich for me to have this conversation with you. But I do want to honor my listeners with the three questions that I end every episode with. And do you think anybody can be an entrepreneur? Not wants to be, because not everyone wants to be, but do you think anybody can be an entrepreneur?
I don't think so. Because early in my journey, I used to be a person, I used to think that everyone could do it. It wasn't until my dad came to me and was like, hey, Quentin, like, everyone can't be an entrepreneur. Like, some people are going to work for you and it's okay. You need brilliant people that are going to be on your team. Everyone can't be an entrepreneur, but everyone can like be a part of the team and work and have their job. So I don't think everyone can be an entrepreneur.
Oh, love it. Absolutely love it. Collectively, this question is for the unit, the two of you. Many people think entrepreneurship is about just head to the grindstone. It's a solo journey. It's all about you and your resilience, that there isn't this army supporting you and this community of people that are helping you along the way. We all know that not to be true. Like, we know where we are today because of the shoulders that we've stood upon. So collectively, when you two think about your entrepreneurial journey, who do you look back to with such immense gratitude for their contribution to where you two stand today?
Parents.
Yep, our parents. And I honestly say the community in general, just all of the people that took us under their wing. Even Nuri, who helped us, he really incubated a lot for us as far as like just Urban Eden, that incubator for Urban Eden, Ruach Akkad, what Quentin had going on. I would honestly say it's been like people that just were genuine with us, that really wanted to see that. But definitely, like Quentin said, our parents, because they had us, they've been our biggest support. I don't know why, but we received such an immense amount of love from people that we don't know. Mm-hmm. But from the people that we've got to know along the way, they've helped us tremendously. And that's why we are able to be where we are today, the community support.
Our parents just allowing us to move back with them. On two occasions, even times where I was just like, man, I'm moving back with my wife to my parents' house. Oh, I'm such a bum. They allowed us to live there and really barely pay anything, you know, just be able to just go all in on the business. So we owe them a lot. And shout out to Craig, our other mentor. Like, he really helped us with the mindset because he's a person that has made millions of dollars before. So he understands what that is like and how lonely it can be. So he really peeled back that. So And of course, the community, like our community, just incredible. Like, I can't even express like how grateful I am for them.
Oh, absolutely love it. Absolutely love it. You know, we've been talking to tens of thousands of listeners about your guys' journey at a high level. And I like to afford, if I could, I would love to arrange a one-on-one meeting with each of my listeners with a founder so they can just kind of unpack their own personal questions. That would be absolutely impossible. And I would never ask that. But I like to leverage this last question as a mentoring minute. And so, Taryn, I'm going to ask you this question. You know, if you're having a coffee with one of my listeners, whether it be the entrepreneur who's frustrated because of coming out of 2020, COVID just destroyed their business, or what if it's the entrepreneur who has ideas that they want to do something, but there's some hurdle, a mental hurdle as to why they think they can't do it. Maybe it's because they think they have a mortgage, their personal expenses are too high. Maybe it's because they think that, you know, they're 60 years old and they think entrepreneurship is for the young. Or maybe it's the female, maybe it's the Black female founder who thinks there are just too many challenges being thrown in the direction of Black female founders. It's not even worth it. Whatever persona that may be, What would you like to say to that person?
So if you are an upcoming entrepreneur, you want to start a business, you have an idea, or you feel like you're struggling within your business, I would honestly say, get out of your own way. Get out of your own way, get out of your own head, and feeling like having you have all these fears that you can't do what you need to do to propel and to excel to the next step in your life. One of my favorite sayings is, ain't nothing to it but to do it. All you gotta do is put your effort, and nobody can do it like you can. But I would also say, stay in your own lane as well. Stay in your own lane. Don't always be looking at what the next person is doing and comparing yourself to the next person. Stay in your own lane and continue to build yourself and elevate yourself so that your business continues to grow. And if you're putting the effort in and executing your ideas, that passion that you have, everything else is going to flow from there. Success is going to flow to you easily.
Once you've had a few moments to process all the value that Quentin and Taryn Lewis brought us in this week's episode, please hit me up on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Instagram and share with me your thoughts on this episode. And lastly, if you've been around the Startup Story for any length of time, then you know how much emphasis I put on the idea that entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs. So please visit Urban Eden, and that's HERBNEDEN.com. Visit UrbanEden.com and try some of their unique products. In fact, if you use the code Startup Story when you check out, you'll receive 15% off your entire order. I say it in every episode because I believe it with my very being. Entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs. So let's show up for Quentin and Taryn in a huge way as a way of saying thank you for all the value they delivered to us today. Again, just visit Urban Eden, that's HERBNEDEN, EDEN.com, and use the code Startup Story to get 15% off your entire order. Real transactions is how we show up for our entrepreneurial community. And now for my personal ask. The Startup Story community has been so incredible about sharing our podcast with others, but we have more stories to tell and more people to reach. We too are a startup, and word of mouth is everything. So please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Startup Story, or on Twitter at StartupStory_. If you're on LinkedIn, please search for The Startup Story and follow our company page. LinkedIn is a really powerful way to raise awareness of the show. But the most impactful way you can help us grow our audience is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Or if you listen to the show via Spotify, then please simply share the podcast directly from your Spotify app or wherever you listen to the show. These simple actions can make a huge impact in getting these amazing founder stories out to the masses. And please make sure to tag or mention The Startup Story when you do share so that we can connect with you and say thank you directly. I'm so incredibly appreciative of the fact that you listen to the show each and every week. And I look forward to sharing these amazing stories with you every Tuesday with hopes of encouraging and inspiring you to start your story. If you like this podcast and are thinking of creating your own, consider talking to my producer, Danny Osmond. He helps thought leaders, influencers, executives, and authors create, launch, and produce podcasts that grow their business and make a real impact in this world. You can contact him today at emeraldcitypro.com/startupstory.